Okay, so now we finally get to, what was your question?
We wanted to know about strategies and tactics to use as activists. And just a quote from Endgame, what is our solution? Probably the most commonly chosen solution is to use only tactics deemed acceptable to those in power. The main advantage of pursuing this non-option is that you get to feel good about yourself for fighting the good fight against the system of exploitation while not actually putting at risk the benefits you gain from the same system. Have you ever wondered why so many people in the North America support rebel groups in the developing world then participate in similarly open revolt here?
Okay, so far as strategy and tactics, yeah, I mean, there's a great line by, I think it's Lucy Parsons, who said, never be deceived that the rich will allow you to vote away their wealth. Somebody asked me, I was doing a film interview the other day, and somebody asked me for a definition, what do I mean when I talk about bringing down civilization? And because that's what we need to do. We need to bring down civilization. I mean, civilization has been killing the planet for 6,000 years. I mean, very, very quick on this is, you know, they say one of the signs of intelligence is the ability to see patterns, to recognize patterns. And I'm going to lay out a pattern here real quick, and let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years, which is when you think of the hillsides of Iraq and the plains of Iraq, do you normally think about cedar forests so thick that sunlight never reaches the ground? That's the first written myth of this culture, is Gilgamesh going in and cutting down those forests to make cities. When we think about the Arabian Peninsula, do we normally think about oak forests, which it used to be? We go a little bit further west. You know, there's the cedars of Lebanon, they still got one on their flag. That used to be heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. That was cut down to make the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. I never can remember which one it was. Excuse me, whether it was Aristotle or Plato or one of those dead guys complained about how deforestation in Greece was destroying their water quality. And I'm presuming, of course, that that those in power said, "Well, we need to study this for a few more years before we act on it." Italy was heavily forested. France, England. I mean, there's a great line by somebody: "Forests precede us, and deserts dog our heels." I mean, this culture has been doing this. I mean, so what I want to do is. Well, what I want, as I said, is to live in a world with more wild salmon, and what I want to do is strike at the root, is to get rid of this culture that is killing the planet. And somebody asked me the other day what I mean by bringing down civilization, and I've never had a really good answer to that question until then. And the answer that I gave, which is I want to deprive the rich of the ability to steal from the poor. And I want to deprive the rich of the ability to destroy the world. And that really I think that pretty much gets to the heart of it. So far as strategy and tactics, I mean, I was talking to my mom the other day, and we were both agreeing that, you know, the whole democracy thing is the biggest, it's one of the biggest cons that's ever been foisted upon the world, this belief. I mean, that's another thing that's pretty funny, is I used to teach at a really conservative university in Eastern Washington University, and I used to just ask my students, so how many of you believe we live in a democracy? And they would just laugh. I mean, the whole thing's a joke, and we all recognize it's a joke, but we keep playing on. And it's the same as true. I mean, I've done so many timber sale appeals, which, by the way, I don't mean to devalue the very important work done by people who do, for example, do timber sale appeals or who work within the system. I think it's really important to work within the system. I think it's very important to use, when I say I'll do whatever it takes, that's not code language for blowing up dams. It's code language for working within the system too, working within and without the system. It's for doing everything. I was pretty appalled. I was doing a talk a while ago, and actually a pretty big talk, maybe 1,000 people there, and I stopped at one point. I don't know why. It was during Q&A. I stopped, and I said, so I'm just wondering how many people here have ever filed it? And we're talking, we're all getting really excited about bringing down civilization. Yeah, let's go do something. And I said, how many people here have ever filed a timber sale appeal? And there were only two people, myself and one other person, raised our hands. And, you know, there's plenty of other ways people can be active that have nothing to do with timber sale appeals. But it suddenly occurred to me that part of the problem is that there are a lot of people who aren't even working inside the system, much less working outside it. And we need to do it all. We need people to file timber sale appeals. We need people to chain themselves to trees. We need people to go after electrical infrastructures. We need people to take out dams. We need people to do everything. And part of the way to look at this is it's really clear to me that the government, and it doesn't matter which government we're talking about because they're all the same in this way, the government is a government of occupation. The culture is a culture of occupation. And, you know, a lot of my American Indian friends are saying, yeah, what took you so long to figure this one out? And what does a government of occupation do? What a government of occupation does is it moves in, takes resources, and doesn't care about communities. It is set up to facilitate the resource extraction. And what would we all do if space aliens were coming down from outer space and they were systematically vacuuming the oceans and they were systematically deforesting the planet and they were putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk? But we did get tomatoes in January, so that's good. And we got nice computers that we can play games on. And, you know, what would we do if they were systematically changing the climate of the planet? If they were doing all the things that are being done by those in power now, what would we do if space aliens were doing that? What would we do if Chinese communists or Russian commie pinkos or Islamo-fascists or whoever the enemy du jour is, what would we do if they were erecting dams on every river and killing every salmon run, every sturgeon run, every, you know, what would we do if they were killing our land base? I think we all know what we would do. Well, yeah, well, we'd watch television, by gum. Okay, I'm not saying, by the way, when I say it's a government occupation, I'm not saying that we shouldn't vote or something. I'm not saying that we shouldn't. I mean, I actually think voting is a big joke. I mean, I would never vote for Republican or Democrat at the national level. Voting, I think, is kind of handy at the local level. I think I voted for Leonard Peltier in the last United States election. Time before that, I think I voted for Emma Goldman. I don't remember who I voted for before. Oh, I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000 and 1996. I voted for Ralph Nader in 1992. I voted for Emma Goldman. The point is that, so far as strategy and tactics, we need it all, and we need to recognize that. And what would we do if we were Russian partisans in World War II? Would we appeal to the government? We have to recognize that the government is not there to serve our interests. The government is there to provide the muscle for and to provide a form of semi-legitimacy to the exploitation of the poor by the rich. I mean, that is the fundamental purpose of government. And it's a measure of our... the sloppiness of much of our thinking and the level of our indoctrination that we fail to immediately recognize that. And there's another thing, actually, about this, too. A couple things about this. One is that this whole question of identity is really important, which, by the way, also, I don't mean to say that just because it's a government occupation, all governments of occupation are the same. If I were in Nazi-occupied Europe, I would much rather have been in Nazi-occupied Denmark than Nazi-occupied Poland because the governor was nicer. So given a choice between a nice governor of occupation and a mean governor of occupation, I'll take a nice one. But that doesn't alter the fact that they're both governors of occupation. And this whole question actually runs pretty deep. I mean, the other day a friend of mine called me up. There's a couple levels I want to talk about this. One of them is the other day a friend of mine called me up and said, so, Derek, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? I'm like, we're in Iraq? I thought we were in Northern California. He's like, you know, Derek, this is why I only call you once every few weeks. How much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? And I said, I got troops? I didn't know I had troops. I mean, can I, like, tell them to go take out a dam and they'll do it? And the point is that if you identify with the government and its agencies, you're going to be fighting yourself as well as them. And I think that that makes things infinitely harder. I don't think that Tecumseh had a problem of figuring out who is us and them. And I think there really is an us and them, and we need to recognize that. And that's one of the big problems is we keep getting our identity all confused with theirs, and that's a very, very big mistake. And the next thing about that is that the identity actually runs deeper than that, though, because if your experience is that your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from a tap, you will defend to the death the system that brings both of those to you because your life depends on that system. This is not belief. This is experience. If your experience is that your food comes from a land base and that your water comes from a river, you know, people actually used to drink from rivers. How quaint is that? And if your experience is that your food comes from a land base, you will defend to the death the land base that gives you that food because your life depends on it. So this whole question of identity, we've been sucked into this system that now our lives depend on this system that is killing everything. And that's a really, really bad situation to be in. And now one more thing before we go to the whole question of strategy and tactics, although we've been talking about that all along, of course, is there's this great book by Robert J. Lifton called The Nazi Doctors. And his fundamental question is, how could people who swore a Hippocratic Oath go and work in a death camp? And what he found was that many of the doctors, he's not talking about Mengele or any of them, he's talking about the regular everyday doctors who went in, how could they possibly work there? And the answer was that a lot of them actually did everything within their power to help the Jews and other inmates under their care. They did everything except for question the larger Auschwitz concentration camp mentality. And so if somebody gets sick, they give them an aspirin to lick, or they hide them for a day or two from the selection people, or if they get typhus, then they kill them. They give them an injection of phenol, because that will keep the typhus from spreading. And so, once again, within the context of the Auschwitz mentality, they're doing everything they can to help the inmates. Of course, except for questioning the larger reality. And if you step outside of that perspective, what they're doing is they're mass murder and genocide. It's horrible. And that really makes me think a lot about environmental activists, because so many of us will do everything we can to save every little scrap of ground that we can, except, of course, for questioning the larger mentality that's killing the planet. And so, you know, we'll act within the system. And it's really important, I need to also say this, that I absolutely disbelieve in the whole reform versus revolution question. That's not a dichotomy. And I really went to understand this when I was teaching creative writing inside Pelican Bay, which is a super maximum security prison. And I recognized every time I walked in, I was participating in the largest, most oppressive gulag system in the planet right now. And at the same time, I mean, so someday, you know, Robert J. Lifton's granddaughter or something would write a book about, you know, the prison system creative writing instructors or something. You know, how could I, who disbelieve in this system, go in and participate? But at the same time, many of my students told me that my classes were the only things that were keeping them sane. And so at that moment, the reform versus revolution question fell apart for me, because we need it all. We need people designing groovy eco-villages. We need people doing other stuff. We need people getting out the vote, for crying out loud. We need people doing everything. Things are so dire. And so now the question of strategy and tactics, and we can talk more about it too, but to finish my little rant here, my tirade, I guess the guy at Sierra Club would say, is that people ask me all the time, so what should I do? And I always say, don't ask me. I don't live there. I don't live where you live. I don't know how to live sustainably. If you want to know what to do, go to the nearest river and ask that river what it wants. And go to the nearest forest and ask the forest what it wants. And go ask anyone who has lived there for thousands, and in the case of rivers, you know, sometimes millions of years. Go ask them what they want. Go ask them how you can help them, how you can serve them. And they'll give you the answers. And so when people, you know, once again, so what do we need to do for strategy and tactics? My first answer is listen. Listen to the natural world. Listen, ask it what it wants and really be ready for the answer.
My next question for you, Derek, to kind of continue on this topic, is, and I'll throw it at some questions you ask in Endgame, actually, which are, what are some of civilization's bottlenecks? What are some of its limiting factors, the objects or processes that, if interdicted, could cause civilization to grind to a halt? Similarly, where can we find the fulcrums to magnify our efforts? Where do we put the levers? What do we use for fulcrums? And how and when and how hard do we push to help topple this culture of death? What are some of your answers to those questions to continue on this topic of strategies and tactics and whatnot?
Well, I just want to say, first off, I think the questions you're asking are really great. Thank you for asking these questions. And, you know, if we're going to think about fighting this culture, we really do need to think about leverage, because we don't have the numbers of humans right now. Well, we don't have the numbers of rich humans. I mean, if you go all around the world, I believe about half the humans in the world, I could be wrong on this, but I believe about half the humans in the world are not part of the global economic system. A lot of them have never had a cash exchange, subsistence farmers, indigenous people. It's really easy to forget here in the industrialized world that there are a lot of people who don't participate in these systems. And of course, who would be better off without the systems immediately? I asked the really good activist Anuradha Mittal, former director of Food First, if the people of India would be better off if the U.S. economy disappeared tomorrow. And she said, of course. She started laughing. An example she gave that has to do with Europe but still applies is that there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. And so there are people starving to death in India so that people in Europe can have dog food and tulips, and people being forced off their land. And it's the same, of course, with coffee or anything else. You know, we don't really need to go into that. But all those people would be better off immediately if the U.S. economy ground to a halt. And but within the industrialized world, we don't have the numbers and the pure force. And which, by the way, is an argument that's often thrown out by pacifists. It's like, look, they have the ability to wage war much better than we do, which means we can never use that tactic. And that's absolutely absurd, because if you go by that, they also have the ability to wage discourse much better. They control the mass media. So if you're going to say we shouldn't fight back using that because they outnumber us, then that means we shouldn't talk either, I guess. And because they have the ability to raise a lot of money, that means we shouldn't use money. I mean, so it just, that doesn't work. What it means is that we need to think about leverage, and we need to think about how we can leverage our efforts. And levers, if you recall from Teeter Totters, are, you know, if you have a long lever arm, you can make it so the force that you exert moves a much bigger object at the other end. And so voting, that's why, you know, I don't say that. But voting is a really interesting example because it's a really, really small lever. I mean, yes, do your bit, go vote. But it's a teensy, teensy little lever, presuming that the votes are even counted. And people say then, vote with your dollars, you know, boycott. And, well, that's a really, really small lever, too. I'm not saying we shouldn't use them. I'm just saying they're really, really small levers. I figured this out. I fly a lot to do my talks. And because I live in a small community, United is the only airline that comes in here. And so I actually figured out how much of their revenue I was responsible for. It was like a couple years ago. And I think it was, and I'm making the number up here, I don't remember what it was, but it was like I was responsible for one out of every $9 billion or something. I don't know. So some really small amount. And so I could boycott. And well, that would be a lever of 1/9 billionth. You know, it's a really, really tiny lever. And then, of course, people will say, well, gosh, you know, what if everybody did it? You could get everybody to boycott. And it's like, well, shoot, if I'm going to fantasize by getting everybody to boycott, why don't I fantasize about, you know, getting everybody to rise up and do a bunch of other things? If, you know, if we're going to fantasize, let's fantasize big. Okay, so then let's think about leverage. And, okay, I'm going to talk. I want to be really explicit here, especially given the whole climate. The whole political climate, that I am not talking about assassinating political figures in the United States or Canada. I am absolutely not talking about that. I want to give an example of leverage from World War II that would have been a huge lever arm. One man by himself almost stopped World War II in its tracks. His name is George Elser. Who? George Elser was a guy who decided he was going to kill Hitler because he didn't like how Hitler was treating the trade unions, among other reasons. And so he meticulously he went to work for a mining company so that he could steal some explosives. And then after that, he moved to Munich, where every year Hitler would give a speech. And then he would sneak into this restaurant, hide there where the speech was given every year, and he would hide there until it was closed. And they would come out, and every night he would remove this one panel and then meticulously chip away at the pillar behind it until he had a space big enough to hold his bomb. And then he put it back, and he set a timer. Every year Hitler gave a speech from 8:30 to 9:30. He set the timer for, I think, 10 after 9. But that year, because of weather, and because of train schedules, Hitler gave a speech from 8 to 9, I believe it was, and left the room, and then the bomb went off at 10 after. And all the members of the German resistance all through said that the key to stopping the Nazi regime was killing Hitler. And so my point once again, I'm not saying we should all send bags of pretzels to George Bush or anything. I'm not saying that. So, you know, all you Fed agents out there can go ahead and just lose your erections. What I'm saying is, in that particular case, that was a really, really long lever. And so what I would like for people to do is think about the ways they can leverage their efforts. And one of the ways to think about leverage is to think also about bottlenecks and to think, where are the, or as they're called in the U.S. military, choke points. And a bottleneck is simply, you know, you're driving down the interstate and then two lanes of traffic are shut down because of, you know, an accident on the right and an accident on the left. We got ourselves a classic bottleneck. What are some of the bottlenecks that make this whole system move forward? Another really good example from World War II is industrial diamonds. The whole Nazi industrial complex would have collapsed within 6 months if industrial diamonds had not continued to flow into the country, with the connivance of De Beers, by the way, from the South African nations. They were smuggled in Red Cross packages. And so that's a really strong bottleneck, is industrial diamonds there. The transportation system in Germany was a big bottleneck. At first, they were just sort of bombing random factories, and then they decided to focus on a ball bearing plant, because if you bomb a tractor plant, then they can't make engines for their tanks. But if you bomb the ball bearing plant, they can't remake the factory, because ball bearings are needed for the factory. And that helped some. But then somebody else had this other idea: why don't we just bomb the transportation system? It's the weakest link. And they did that, and that had more effect on the German industrial economy than any of the other bombings that they did. That was what really crippled. And so, once again, I can't speak to different locales, but... Well, that's one of the things, though, is it's not locale, it's a larger system. I mean, that's something to just think about, is what are the bottlenecks, personal? I mean, and this doesn't mean simply, you know, going and blowing stuff up. What this also is like, these are true in relationships, too. You know, what are the bottlenecks in relationships that you either want to, within a personal relationship that you want to expand and you want to have flourish, you might want to try to see what you can do about that bottleneck, either to make the person feel comfortable with it or to help them get rid of it if necessary, whatever. And, you know, what are our social bottlenecks? And I think it's really incumbent upon, I mean, okay, here's a bottleneck that I read about on the internet the other day. It's pretty interesting. I don't remember what they're called. They are, this isn't actually in the book, because I just heard about this the other day. Somebody sent me some email. I thought it was pretty interesting. But it ends up that the way, you know, if somebody goes to www.blahblahblah.org, then what they're actually doing is they send out a request to a place that's basically like a routing system, like has a big phone book there that says that the, you know, www.blahblahblah.org is on some guy's server in the middle of western Kansas, you know, in his backyard or whatever, you know, in his basement, whatever. Or, you know, maybe it's in, I mean, the information is actually held in physical places. But the problem is finding the addresses, and there's only like three or four of those in the country, I believe. And, I mean, that's a huge and actually, frankly, pretty stupid bottleneck. In fact, I think I read something, and I could be getting confused on this because I didn't understand all the technical stuff, but I think that the Europeans were getting really upset at that the other day, because what it does is it allows, since they're in the United States, it allows the United States to control basically all the Internet traffic. That, by the way, I was talking to some hackers, and that's one of the reasons, by the way, that so many hackers are very, very political, and so many of them attack Microsoft is because what they're attempting to do is show how stupid it is to allow one corporation to control global communications. And that's why they keep hitting it again and again and again, is to say, look, this is a bottleneck. And a lot of them aren't actually attempting to destroy the system. A lot of them are attempting to point out the stupidity of that particular bottleneck. Microsoft is a huge bottleneck, which, you know, once again, hackers recognize everywhere. That's all for now, I guess.